Looking to Sea by Lily Lebrun. Chapter 1. Studland Beach. Vanessa Bell. September again. Back on Studland Beach. Sitting in the shallows of the dunes, she can see the full sweep of the bay. The sand, pockmarked with shadows where the children have left footprints, swells out wide in front of her and disappears in pincers to her left and right behind thickets of marram grass. The sea glitters in the midday heat. She holds her hat against a cooling gust of wind, noticing how every broken wave darkens a fresh strip of sand. Why did she think she could paint here? A canvas would become a sail, and the light is as temperamental as a child. Passing clouds brighten or dull the scene with the rapidity of a mood. She sees her son Julian and his nursemaid returning slowly from a walk. They settle at her feet and turn their attentions towards the children on the shore. Putting her worn wooden painting box on her lap, she knows she should try to work while her toddler is absorbed. Opening it, she finds the familiar company of oil tubes, strips of rag and a yellowing bottle of Terps. How pointless it is to describe a colour with words, she thinks, checking for her blues. Cobalt blue, cerulean blue, Prussian blue. She takes a board from its slot inside the box and props it against the lid where it is shielded from the wind. Working quickly, she lays out her paints along the palimpsests, from the large white ghost to the small shadow of black. She wets her fattest brush with Terps and looks up. A canvas bathing tent is being pushed awkwardly on small wheels towards the shore, close to where the children cluster. It will help to find them against the bright sea, so she waits for it to rumble to a stop before beginning the painting. Go. Her brush obeys her, swooping down the sloped dune, moving diagonally back and forth over the beach, and then vertically up and down for the fluttering tent. She uses a fat, upward-thrusting curve to draw the woman standing next to it and slithering lines to conjure the children, playing at her feet. She swiftly describes the silhouettes of Julian and his nurse in blocks of blue in the bottom left-hand corner of the board, and their hats as ovals of gold ochre and pale green. She uses a touch of black for their thick bands of ribbon and for the shape of the brim. She wipes her brush thoroughly on a rag before going over the tent again in pure white, making sure it is brighter than the murkier pale of the beach. Her models by the tent are standing up. They've seen something. The dog, perhaps, or have they been called for lunch? As they disappear from sight, she sets down her brush. That will have to do for now. Sometime after Vanessa Bell returns home to London, the hasty sketch of the beach becomes the seedling for a much larger painting, Studland Beach. The canvas she picks to work on is just under a metre tall and just over a metre wide. She covers its surface with a brown-red ground to intensify any blue laid on top. Then she outlines the scene she sees on the oil-on-board sketch, copying the child and woman wearing large hats in the left-hand corner, the woman standing beside a bathing tent with a pinched roof, the group of four children playing close to her feet, the diagonal shoreline dividing the scene in half. As she builds up the painting in layers of colour, she simplifies the composition, removing a suggestion of rocks or boats further down the shoreline and cropping out the horizon. The figures in the left corner acquire Venetian red clothing to counterbalance the cornflower blue sea to their right. She lowers the arms of the woman standing by the bathing tent, swaps her pale pink dress for a sky blue tunic, loosens her hair and turns her to face the sea. Using small, compact brushstrokes, she makes the edges of shapes neat and better defined. The sand becomes an elongated white triangle, roughly bisecting the canvas. Sky and sea emerge into a single flat wedge. The bathing tent no longer flaps in the breeze. It juts into the blue, rigid as a lighthouse. Studland Beach is in the collection of Tate Britain, where it normally hangs at the hinge of the 19th and 20th centuries in their chronology of British art. One floor below is the archive, where Bell's family photograph albums are kept. She had the future in mind when she compiled them, for on each concrete grey cardboard page she has written a place and a year, and a name or initial beneath every person in each snapshot. Under Stutland 1909, there are three pictures of Julian Bell tottering happily across the sand in a cotton tunic and straw sun hat, clutching a spade. Vanessa kneels beside him in one, reaching out her hand to steady his back. She is dark-haired and slender, with a gentle expression and large hooded eyes. She has recently turned 30. Stutland 1910. More snapshots of Julian and many images of Clive Bell, Vanessa's husband, Julian's father. Friends and family who accompanied the Bells to Stutland also start to make an appearance, including Vanessa's younger sister, Virginia Stephen, not yet married to Leonard Wolfe, and a little later, on the pages headed Stutland 1911, the art critic and painter Roger Fry. To connect these photographs to the painting, to discover how Stutland became Stutland Beach, I need more words than names and places. But in the biographic Bell, Vanessa, section of the London Library, I only find four books. Francis Spaulding's 1983 biography, Bell's Selected Letters, edited by Regina Marler in 1993, and Sketches in Pen and Ink, a collection of memoirs Bell wrote in the 1930s and 1940s. The other, Jane Dunn's A Very Close Conspiracy, concerned Bell's relationship with her younger sister, Virginia Woolf, who herself is the subject of enough biographies to fill two long shelves. The art section also reveals that Bell has seldom been studied in her own right. Her work is there, but shares its pages with the coterie of English artists and intellectuals known as Bloomsbury. There is a catalogue from her solo retrospective at the Dulwich Picture Gallery in South London that took place earlier in the year, the first ever to be staged. But even that had opened with her portraits of family and friends. The curators were eager to establish a new independent identity for Bell, arguing passionately in their essays that her art was pioneering and that she was by nature progressive. Even so, by showing her first and foremost at the centre of a social circle, they re-emphasise the main reason she has been valued in the past. Vanessa Bell is a central character in the often-told tale of Bloomsbury, the group of free-spirited creatives who challenged the social and aesthetic conventions of their day, or so the story goes. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given that it was initially chronicled by Wolfe, Bell comes across in the narrative as the perennial older sister. Grounded, caring, capable, loved. Her key contribution to the group was not so much to do with her talent as a painter or her intellect, but with her abilities as a hostess. It was she who prepared the stage for her drama to begin. Plotting, after her father's death in 1904, her and her siblings' flight across London from 22 Hyde Park Gate in Kensington to 46 Gordon Square in Bloomsbury. The most beautiful, the most exciting, the most romantic place in the world. So it seemed to Wolfe at the time. There, life would begin afresh. We were going to paint, to write, to have coffee after dinner instead of tea at 9 o'clock. Everything was going to be new. Everything was going to be different. Everything was on trial. Later on, Charleston Farmhouse in Sussex, Bell's home from 1916, became the centre of Bloomsbury activities and remains a kind of shrine to the group today. Stutland Beach emerges from all the writing on Vanessa Bell as something of an anomaly. Hardly any of her works have been treated by prosperity so well. Despite a growing curiosity about her career, the general consensus is that her drive to experiment and innovate faded after the First World War, and with that when her chances of being recognised as a truly important artist. Stutland Beach, however, has been praised by leading art historians for being an outstanding contribution to modernism in Britain. It is owned by the Tate and is normally part of the small selection of works from their collection chosen to be on public display. Of the many works we have borrowed from the Tate, only the one of Stutland Beach is regularly on the walls. The rest were all in storage. The director of the Dulwich Picture Gallery told The Guardian in advance of the retrospective. We had lots of the family in for an early look. There are scores of them, all ravishingly beautiful. It's in the genes. And they were running from wall to wall, remarking on how many of the pictures they'd never seen before. In the exhibition, it was hung proudly in the final room, as if it was crucial proof that Bell deserved a retrospective. The wall text described her work as her modern masterpiece. Though it is probably her most famous painting, neither in her brief memoirs nor copious letters, she kept no diary, does Bell mention Stutland Beach directly. Scholars do not even know the exact date it was painted. 1912 to 13 is an estimate calculated by the Tate and by Frances Spaulding, her biographer, based on an assessment of its style in relation to the rest of her work and what her relations have said. Of course, her thoughts on the painting might easily have been lost. If she was not valued as a painter at the time, then there would have been no reason to treasure every piece of correspondence or note every conversation. She also might not have realised that painting was particularly important. It is not known to have been exhibited during her lifetime, and it first attracted the attention of art historians in the 1970s. There is a danger, too, of being anachronistic. Artists then were not expected to explain their work to the extent they are today. There is a mystery, though, to this painting that has little to do with lack of information. When I first saw Studland Beach at Tate Britain, I noticed how it bore hardly an affinity to the sentimental seaside scenes and hazy seascapes hanging nearby. Without knowing its title, in fact, it might be difficult to see the beach in it at all. Its dusty red, white, and blue colour scheme resembles an antiqued tricolour flag, graphic and subdued. When I last saw it within the context of the rest of her work, its oddness was pronounced. It carried a strange melancholy not shared with any other painting in the whole show. Like a person afflicted by loneliness, it was taciturn and self-contained, reluctantly radiating waves of the wrong kind of feeling. I was curious. Here was a painting widely seen as leading the charge toward modernism, a movement premised on novelty, experiment, and contempt of nostalgia, and a painting of a day at the beach, an activity linked to pleasure and play. Why, then, did it seem freighted with sadness? I'm not the only one who has sensed its brooding mood. I've spoken to people who say that it makes them think of death or the pain-stricken landscapes of Edvard Munch. I've read descriptions of its fundamental solitude or otherworldliness and pared-down mysticism. Explanations have been offered. The Dulwich curators suggest that the painting involuntarily picks up on a period of unhappiness in Vanessa's marriage when her husband and her sister, the two people she cared for most in the world, grew dangerously close for a period after Julian was born. Frances Spaulding connects the painting's austere and remote feeling to the static and separate nature of its shapes. She also suggests, as others have too, that it might be related to the artist's experience of being a mother. Women and children were a motif that Vanessa returned to time and time again, especially around this period when her children were young. Her second son, Quentin, was born on 19th of August 1910. According to Spaulding, she was a devoted and interested mother to her boys, although her daughter, Angelica Garnett, born in 1918, told a different story in her memoir, Deceived with Kindness. But also, throughout her life, she revered her own mother, Julia, who died when she was a teenager. But none of these other pictures seem to share Studland Beach's particular sense of melancholy. Might the setting have anything to do with it? Virginia Woolf's memoirs are laced with reminiscences of childhood summers spent on the Cornish coast, when the whole household from 22 Hyde Park Gate in London, including servants, nursemaid, cook and dog, decamped for months at a time to Tallant House on the hills above St Ives Bay. Her father, Sir Leslie Stephen, an eminent writer and critic, had discovered it on a walking holiday. Virginia imagines him munching a sandwich, perhaps high up on a hotel terrace, looking over a town, largely untouched since the 16th century, and thinking how well this would do for his growing family. Its attainable remoteness appealed to the once obsessive mountaineer, now grounded by fatherhood. "Did I tell you I've bought a little house at St. Ives, down a very toenail of England?" he wrote to a friend in January 1881. "The children will be able to run straight out of the house to a lovely bit of sand and have a good air and quiet." After his first wife died, he had married the widowed Julia Duckworth in 1878. This gave Laura, his daughter from his first marriage, who had developmental disabilities, three half-siblings: George, Stella, and Gerald. Julia gave birth to Vanessa in 1879. Phoebe and Virginia followed in quick succession. By the time his final child, Adrian, was born in 1883, Leslie Stephen had gained seven children in 5 years. In choosing St. Ives, Sir Leslie rejected the bustling seaside resorts that had attracted most other upper-middle-class Victorian families since the expansion of the railways in the early 19th century. He desired something more rustic and removed, somewhere to hike vertiginous coastal paths, not promenade along crowded esplanades. Few of his friends would have chosen a pilchard-smelling working fishing village as a holiday destination. Those that did would have likely stayed away in one of the hotels high above it, such as Tregenna Castle Hotel up the road, where Henry James based himself when he came to visit. St. Ives was far from wealthy, and Julia Stephen, by all accounts a relentless do-gooder, spent much of her summer tending to its poor and sick. Vanessa and Virginia spent their summers as tomboys, outdoors and in plimsolls. They played cricket, scaled trees, abandoned woolen stockings for icy water, tucked up their skirts and crouched by rock pools, found they could float in the waves, learned to keep up on marathon afternoon walks. As night fell, they set out rags soaked in rum and treacle to trap moths and rinsed away salt water and sand to find their skin darker by the day. Years later, Virginia remembered her elder sister teaching herself to draw and paint. She was a happy creature, beginning to feel within her the spring of unsuspected gifts, that the sea was beautiful and might be painted some day. Life at Talent House felt so different from life in London that Vanessa once asked her father whether St. Ives was a separate world with its own sky. At 22 Hyde Park Gate, a tall, dark house in the pit of a cul-de-sac in Knightsbridge, children's days were regular and habitual. A cycle of tutors and nannies, twice daily walks along the straight paths of Kensington Gardens, father reading to them in the drawing room, bath and supper in the night nursery. London was cosy, cosseted, laced into routines. Cornwall was hearing your name called and knowing you would not be found if you did not choose to return. Like her parents, Vanessa also seemed to have been drawn to the coast for the sake of her young children. The first summer after Julian was born, on 4th February 1908, the family spent a short time in St. Ives. The following year she was looking to return. "Is there any chance that the cottage you had in Cornwall would be let for a month from September 10th? Virginia wrote to a friend in July 1909. "Nessa thinks Cornwall would be much nicer than Northumberland. They want 5 bedrooms and to be near a beach for Julian. That Cornish cottage, for some reason, did not work out. Stutland, a beachside village on the Isle of Purkbeck Peninsula in Dorset, was chosen instead. The Bells returned to lodgings in Stutland at least 4 times between 1909 and 1912. According to the 1914 edition of The Thorough Guide to South Hants and Dorset, it was a most rural and charming place, at present unspoiled but certainly discovered. Other than a beachside cafe and the odd bathing tent, it had so far managed to avoid the tourist development seen in the nearby resort towns of Weymouth, Swanage and Lyme Regis, whose sands were riddled with large white timber bathing huts and food stalls and lined by tarmac esplanades and lodging houses. At Stutland, the guidebook promises all ceremony and conventionalism are thrown aside, and it is to be hoped will long remain so, ensuring real enjoyment without any boredom. In other words, it would have resembled Cornwall when Vanessa was young. She did not pick this place because she wished to paint the sea. She painted it because she was there. She always painted wherever she could, and she was there because the beach was one of the few places where families spent time, informally, together. She did not seem to care that Dorset was being surreptitiously appropriated by artists, as another guidebook from the time warned. She did not choose, as these other artists did, to paint the towering cliffs or rolling farmland, sprinkled with convenient romantic details, ruined castles, tumbled-down cottages, abandoned quarries. Nor did she seek to socialise with any artists there other than those she invited herself. The snapshots in her family album suggest that she spent most of her time on Stutland Sandley Beach with family and friends, her watchful eye trained on her children. Descriptions of days there carry an echo of those from her childhood. "We are in the quietest of regions," Sir Leslie had written from Talent House in 1882, "where a tourist is a rarity, and the news that a horse is in sight sends the children rushing to the garden wall for a view of the phenomenon. Julia and the little ones spend most of the mornings on the beach and in the sea, and they are all putting on fat and getting sunburnt." Nearly 3 decades later, Virginia wrote to a friend from Stutland, telling her how Julian rushes straight into the sea and falls flat on his face. "Nessa tucks her skirts up and wades about with him.
Clive, meanwhile, dives from a boat in a tight black suit. Yesterday I hired a bathing dress and swam far out until the seagulls played over my head, mistaking me for a drifting sea anemone. The picture that emerges of the Bells' happy family holidays does not help me make sense of Stutland Beach. I have a postcard of the painting, and each time I look at it, my eye scoots from the woman and child on the left straight to the woman standing by the tent where it lingers. She is so strange and isolated, standing on the threshold of that ice-white tower. It's a white oblivion, white out, white noise, white wash. She is zoning out, not joining in. How to reconcile the two accounts? Then I find Lisa Tickner's close, scholarly study on Stutland Beach, and I read, Stutland would have been resonant with memories of her mother, because holidays with her own children at Stutland invoke memories of St. Ives, and St. Ives had come to stand for a childhood bliss, cut off peremptorily with the death of Julia. The place reminds Vanessa of her mother, Tickner suggests, and the painting registers her feeling of bereavement. In the spring of 1895, the year Vanessa turned 16, Julia Stephen became ill and died on the morning of 5th of May. According to Virginia's memoir, 22 Hyde Park Gate grew thick with grief, changed awfully by a continuous drizzle of visitors, the strong scent of flowers in the hall, and her father's open distress. He mourned with exhausting Victorian melodrama, crying and groaning, flinging out his arms and calling his children to him. With mother's death, the various, merry family life which she had held in being shut forever, she writes. In its place, a dark cloud settled over us. We seemed to sit all together cooped up, sad, solemn, unreal, under a haze of heavy emotion. It seemed impossible to break through. It was not merely dull, it was unreal. A finger seemed laid on one's lips. She describes Julia's death as the greatest disaster that could happen. The period that followed compounded the family's unhappiness. 2 years later, Stella, newly married and pregnant, died of an infection after what Vanessa always remembered as a time of horrible suspense, muddle, mismanagement, hopeless fighting against the stupidity of those in power. Now the eldest daughter, Vanessa, became burdened with the emotional demands of her father, as well as domestic responsibilities, keeping household accounts, playing hostess to callers, caring for Virginia, who was showing signs of deep mental unease. A month after Julia's death, the lease on Talent House was sold. The sudden severance had its greatest, almost obvious impact on Virginia, only 13 when her mother died, who became infected by a profound nostalgia for Cornwall. She was enchanted by the sea, its ebbs and flows throughout her diary, correspondence and work. Not only did it provide the setting for some of her most celebrated novels, The Voyage Out, 1915, Jacob's Room, 1922, To the Lighthouse, 1927, and The Waves, 1931, but its imagery seeped into her most landlocked stories. Cornwall lured her back time again, mind, body, pen. As an adult, she visited wherever she could. Beloved, she wrote to Vanessa on Christmas Day, 1909. I went for a walk in Regent's Park yesterday morning, and it suddenly struck me how absurd it was to stay in London, with Cornwall going on all the time. She went directly to the station and caught a train, arriving in country with no pocket handkerchief, watch key, notepaper, spectacles, checkbook, looking glass, or coat. She was perfectly aware of the reasons for its powerful attraction. Why am I so incredibly and incurably romantic about Cornwall? She wrote in her diary on the eve of another trip to the country. Once past, I suppose, I see the children running in the garden, a spring day, life so new, people so enchanting, the sound of the sea at night. Did the sea rush into Vanessa's life and work with the same urgency? Not in any obvious way. Her choice of subject matter in the surviving paintings does not suggest so. To my knowledge, Stutland Beach was the last time she painted the sea, even though Charleston, where she lived until her death in 1961, is only a few miles from the coast. Landscape and the particularities of place did not really interest her. I know you think it don't matter much where one is, and theoretically you're right, Roger Fry once wrote to her, guiltily relaying his love of painting Provence. It is understandable, though, that when Vanessa became a mother herself, she sought one of the places from her own childhood where she had felt the closest to her parents. And, like most city dwellers, she experienced the sea in parentheses. It appeared in short, discrete pockets of time within her normal life. There was little overlap between her London life and her summers on the coast. As an adult watching her own children on the beach, the passage of time must have felt acute, her presence and her past intermingling before her eyes. For it is rare to be able to see far away in a city. The edges of the sky are continually irritated by trees and lampposts and buildings. What you see from the beach, by contrast, is unadulterated deep distance. The sea derives its very colour from this fact. Blue, as Rebecca Solnit has so beautifully written, is the light that got lost. Light at the blue end of the spectrum does not travel the whole distance from the sun to us. It disperses among the molecules of the air. It scatters in water. Water is colourless. Shallow water appears to be the colour of whatever lies underneath it. But deep water is full of this scattered light. The purer the water, the deeper the blue. In the 15th century, a trick was discovered for conveying distance in water. Warm colours, brown, yellow, gold, should be used for the foreground, while cool colours, grey, blue, silver, should be reserved for the background. Stutland Beach uses this formula. Browns and reds are loaded onto the larger figures nearest the painter, while the blues are kept for the sea and the figures further away. Blue, the colour of distance, has become the colour of longing and of the unknowable, too. For Solnit, it is a mark of where you can never go, for the blue is not in the place those miles away at the horizon, but in the atmospheric distance between you and the mountains. Children, she points out, aren't interested in distance. Their mental landscape is like that of a medieval painting, a foreground full of vivid things, and then a wall. The blue of distance comes with time, with the discovery of melancholy, of loss, the texture of longing, of the complexity of the terrain we traverse, and with the years of travel. I look at Vanessa's painting again and notice how the children play close to the ground, concentrating on the sand immediately before them, while the woman near them stands, soaking up the distance. The more I learn about Vanessa Bell, however, the more uncomfortable I feel about pinning stories to her painting. Her infrequent discussions of her own work around the period she visited Stutland are self-effacing, pragmatic and often technical. There is little self-analysis. Instead, she conveys a deep suspicion of symbols and sentiment in art, as well as relief that she feels it is not her duty, as an artist, to theorise or think too hard about what painting means. This is in keeping with the general tone of her letters, which is overwhelmingly light-hearted and self-deprecating. In contrast to her sister's letters, there is little introspection or intellectual athleticism, more optimism and ready wit. Yet where she must give advice or reprimand, she is wise and careful, rarely flippant. Virginia once described her letter writing as something unexpected, like coming round a corner in a rose garden and finding it still daylight. Vanessa's response, "I had a charming long letter from you this morning with flattering hints of rose gardens and daylight round corners, and I don't know what all. I purr all down my back when I get such gems of imagery thrown at my feet and reflect how envied I shall be of the world some day when it learns on what terms I was with that great genius." I begin to suspect that the silence surrounding Stutland Beach is significant. Reading Sketches in Pen and Ink, a collection of autobiographical essays Vanessa wrote to read to Bloomsbury's Memoir Club in the 1930s, it quickly became clear how the silent kingdom of paint, Virginia's words, were always Vanessa's domain. She could not remember a time when she was not going to be a painter and Virginia a writer. From childhood, so she always claimed, life apart from human beings was almost completely visual. It was something that set her apart from her literary family, and it developed into an enduring method of escape. One of the essays shows that her abiding memory of the art classes she took as a teenager was of somewhere one could forget oneself and think of nothing but shapes and colours and the absorbing difficulties of oil paint. Another reveals one of the most important events of her life to be an art exhibition. When Manet and the Post-Impressionists open at the Grafton Galleries, just off Bond Street, on the 7th of November 1910, she felt here was a sudden pointing to a possible path, a sudden liberation and encouragement to feel for oneself,
which were absolutely overwhelming. It was as if at last one might say things one had always felt instead of trying to say things that other people told one to feel. What had others been telling her to feel? What had she been trying to say? Though prestigious, Vanessa's art education had been utterly conventional, appropriate for a talented daughter of the upper middle classes. In 1901, she became one of 20 students accepted to the painting school of the Royal Academy, a gloomy great place even on its festive nights, according to her sister's teenage diary. For 3 years, two of which were spent in gender-segregated classes, she followed a syllabus barely changed since the school's founding in 1769. Anatomy, portraiture, perspective and composition, drawing from life and from plaster casts of antique sculptures. There was little opportunity to see anything that deviated very far from the Royal Academy's tastes. Its exhibitions were enormously popular, and other galleries in London followed its lead. There had been attempts to challenge its hegemony. Artists who refused to become Royal Academicians or were not invited to join formed independent groups and organised their own shows. Many, though, settled into styles that were more acceptable by the mainstream, leaving more progressive members and aspirant outsiders frustrated. Long after graduating, Vanessa had the oppressive sense that, above one were the professors saying, draw for 7 years, learn anatomy and chemistry and use of the stump, a drawing tool, and in the galleries were their works. Yet, there are seeds of rebellion in her letters from this time. When George Friedrich Watts, a celebrated painter by the Victorians and a proud acquaintance of her parents, gave her a long lecture in front of a painting of his that was, he told her, a protest against Impressionism, she concludes witheringly that his ideas don't come to much. She pored over a book of tiny reproductions of paintings by artists such as Manet, Degas and Monet, images that made her realise, strangely late, that living painters might be as alive as the dead, and there was something besides the lovely quality of old paint to be aimed at. By her final year at the RA, she was confident enough to dismiss John Ruskin, preeminent critic of the Victorian era, author of the book that taught her how to draw as a child, as generally amusing but no good on art. He never cares for anything unless it is a symbol or has several deep meanings, which doesn't seem to me to be what one wants. When she graduated in 1904, she quickly concluded that more of the same sort of teaching would be a waste of time. She began at the Slade School of Fine Art, a younger and slightly more progressive institution than the RA, but nonetheless left after a term. One always must have something of one's own to say that no one else has been able to say, she explained to a friend. But the moment one imitates other people, one's done for. It's allowable while one's a student, learning the language and trying to find out what one does think of it all. But when once one starts alone, one must be oneself. The developments in her own life must have seemed increasingly out of step with the slow pace of change in her profession. Earlier in the year, Vanessa and her siblings had moved to Bloomsbury, where they behaved largely as they pleased and socialised with whom they like. Her letters show her addressing friends by their Christian names, speaking of sex more freely and revelling in bawdy language. I think it's safe to say that at this time, writes Regina Marler, who edited and compiled her letters into a book, no other middle-class woman in London wrote letters like Vanessa's. Vanessa married in 1907, but still enjoyed considerable freedoms. Clive Bell had been a friend for years, she accepted his third proposal of marriage, and respected her desire to paint. He came from a wealthy family, which allowed him to write art criticism and her to paint without the pressure of needing to earn much of an income from either. They could also afford one or two servants, crucial in Vanessa's case, for continuing to work. Yet in doing so, she was making social history, as Francis Spaulding points out. A wife in Vanessa's position was expected at this date to be a monument of virtue and chastity, denied a profession, devoid even of those minor domestic talents that in earlier times had been cultivated as crafts, a conspicuous consumer of her husband's wealth. She was expected to be largely ignorant, not only of the sources of that wealth, but also of the baser male instincts. This must be why, all those years later, Vanessa remembers her experience of the 1910 Grafton Gallery exhibition, Manet and the Post-Impressionists, as a personal and not just artistic epiphany. Here was a sudden pointing to a possible path. Freedom was given to be oneself. For the first time, she saw work by people who seemed to speak her language of form, colour and line, rather than using painting as a vehicle for storytelling or for showing off technical skill.
they showed a vivid faith in the world contained within the painting. They were not just a minority either. This was a movement. The curators had gathered over 200 pictures by the most innovative artists on the continent, including 8 paintings by Manet, at least 42 works by Gauguin, 25 by Van Gogh, 21 by Cézanne, 3 paintings by Picasso and 2 by Matisse, and many more of their drawings and sculptures. It was an astonishing group of pictures. Today they would be valued at well over £1 billion. Many are now in museum collections. But to most Edwardian eyes, these pictures were no better than children's doodles. The colours were ridiculously untrue, the drawing was crude, and the subjects dull and unattractive. However much the curators argued that the post-impressionism was in a natural development from what had gone before, hence its name, most of the 25,000 visitors to the exhibition could not see it in those terms. Regarded by many as a wounding assault on the old order, it provoked an outcry of a kind that is almost impossible to imagine today. The pictures prompted vomiting, accusations of evil, fainting fits, laughing fits, vigorous umbrella shaking, and a flood of impassioned letters to the newspapers. A woman writing for the Daily Herald gleefully grouped the artists with the great rebels of the world, the suffragettes and the socialists, who were both post-impressionists in their desire to scrap old decaying forms and to find for themselves a new working ideal. Quietly rebellious, Vanessa saw a path unfurling before her. The autumn of 1910 is to me a time when everything seemed springing to life, she remembered. A time when all was a sizzle of excitement, new relationships, new ideas, different and intense emotions all seemed crowding into one's life. There was something else, too. Guiding her through the galleries, when possible, was the man responsible for the show, Roger Fry. I remember those times very clearly, she wrote in another essay for the Memoir Club a month after his death. I think I was uneasy at first, distrustful, no doubt, of my own taste and afraid to give myself away. All the same, that cannot have lasted long. For though I did not agree with much of what I understood to be his theories then, I certainly said so. I found it easy enough to listen and talk to someone whose feelings about most of the actual works were so largely in agreement with one's own. Vanessa had not really known Fry before 1910, except by reputation. 13 years older than her, he was a famous lecturer on Italian Renaissance and vaguely associated in her mind with the intimidating men of the New English Art Club, rivals of the Royal Academy. They'd met briefly some years before at a dinner party and then again in 1910, January, while she was waiting with Clive for a train at Cambridge. On the way back to London, the men's conversation continued unceasingly, leaving Vanessa free to observe Fry properly for the first time. As he sat opposite me in the corner, she vividly remembered, I looked down at his face bent a little down towards his MS, but not reading, considering, listening, waiting to reply. Intensely alive, but quiet. What astonishing beauty, I thought, looking at the austere modelling in the flat, bright sidelights from the train windows. I do not think I talked much, but he was becoming a real person to me. Soon after, Fry enlisted Clive Bell to be one of his picture-gathering accomplices for the gap he'd been entrusted to fill in the winter exhibition programme at the Grafton Galleries. The inspiration for Manet and the post-impressionists stemmed mainly from Cézanne, whose paintings Fry first truly noticed in a group exhibition in London in 1906, the year of the artist's death. Vanessa had also seen this show and had been impressed by his work without knowing why. Born in Aix-en-Provence in 1839, Cézanne was the same generation as the Impressionist painters and shared their desire to give a true sense of perception through close, honest observations. But Fry saw a difference. I gradually recognised, he recalled in 1920, that what I had hoped for as a possible event of some future century had already occurred, that art had begun to recover once more the language of design and to explore its so long neglected possibilities. He saw in the work of Cézanne, and a little later Gauguin and Van Gogh, a sense of design that he valued so highly in the work of past masters and could not see in the Impressionists, who predominated avant-garde thinking. The Impressionist emphasis on representing surface appearances had made their work flimsy, he thought, lacking in the underlying structures that gave an artwork its strength. Rather than creating a suggestive haze of shimmering colour with short,
thick brush strokes, Cézanne painted taut blocks of strong colour with slow and decisive marks. In addition to his excitement about Cézanne, Fry had become increasingly fascinated by non-European art. He was particularly intrigued by its ability to convey a strong visual message without bearing any similarity to an image that a Westerner might consider more real. How could these artworks, so different from anything he'd previously seen, provoke in him such familiar reactions? He concluded that the value of a work of art must lie in the feelings it evoked in the viewer, not in its fidelity to its subject matter. Fry began to formulate a theory that was to have a lasting influence on art in England. In An Essay in Aesthetics, 1909, he argued that form, the lines, colours, tones, angles and shapes that make up how a painting looks, could convey emotion in itself. An artist is drawn to an object not for its associations, he wrote, but for its pure form alone. Who has not, once at least in his life, had a sudden vision of landscape as pure form? He asks. For once, instead of seeing it as fields and cottages, he felt it as lines and colours. In that moment, has he not won from material beauty a thrill indistinguishable from that which art gives? His conclusion was radical, unlocking the door to pure abstraction, something that no artist in Europe had yet attempted. We may, then, he wrote, dispense once and for all with the idea of likeness to nature, of correctness or incorrectness as a test, and consider only whether the emotional elements inherent in natural form are adequately discovered. The meaning and power of an artwork, Fry was beginning to suggest, was independent from what it was trying to depict. Vanessa Bell may not have read Fry's essay yet, but she discussed and challenged his theories as they slowly made their way together around Manet and the post-impressionists, looking carefully at the pictures. Gradually he would seem to see new meaning, new relations. He would talk about them, asking, questioning, saying what he thought, but always anxious to know what you thought. It is true that I have learnt to see many things through looking at them with him, but I think I can truthfully say that I have learnt to see them, not only to know that they were there. It was a delight to share his feelings and have him to express them, but it was not undelightful to differ, to stick perhaps to one's own stupid prejudices, but to try to understand why he felt as he did. Fry became mesmerised by what he once described, in reverential terms normally reserved for art, as Vanessa's miracle of rhythm. She did everything, he noticed, with a soothing ease that encouraged an atmosphere of freedom. Over the coming months, their friendship deepened. In the spring of 1911, he accompanied the Bells on a holiday to Turkey. Vanessa fell ill and suffered a miscarriage. Fry became Vanessa's nurse and, soon after, erased perhaps by Clive and Virginia's closeness, her lover. The relationship ended, to Fry's distress, in 1913, when Vanessa became infatuated with the painter Duncan Grant, but they always remained close. Many years later, she wrote to Fry that the first part of our affair was one of the most exciting times of my life, for apart from the new excitement about painting, finding for the first time someone whose opinion one cared for, who sympathised with and encouraged one, you know I really was in love with you. There is a photograph in Vanessa's album of Roger Fry on Stutland Beach in September 1911, sitting on a stool with a painting box on his lap, a stray child's sandal and flapping newspaper at his feet. He is smiling and his mouth is open, as it is in most pictures of him, as though he was always on the cusp of saying something. He sounded exhausting, Virginia Woolf observed, under his influence, his pressure, his excitement, picture, hats, cotton goods, all were connected. Everyone argued. Anyone's sensation, his cooks, his housemaids, was worth having. Learning did not matter. It was the reality that was all important. When she left Stutland, Vanessa felt his absence keenly. She wrote to him in her typically self-derogatory and flirtatious way. I've really been painting so little and so badly since you went that if it weren't for what you say, I should be very gloomy about it. I succeeded this morning in making my yesterday's failure still more of a failure and have given it up in despair. As momentum for a second post-impressionist exhibition gathered over the year, they seemed to have discussed art endlessly, her theories and his theories. This time English painters were to participate, Vanessa among them. Four of her pictures were eventually included. Stutland Beach was not. The show opened in October 1912, and it might not yet have been painted. In the catalogue, Fry kicked back against the furious reaction to the first exhibition pushing his own ideas even further. The feeling on the part of the public may, and I think in this case does, arise from a simple misunderstanding of what these artists set out to do, he wrote. The difficulty springs from a deep-rooted conviction, due to a long-established custom, that the aim of painting is the descriptive imitation of natural forms. Now, these artists do not seek to give what can, after all, be a pale reflex of actual appearance, but to arouse the conviction of a new and definite reality. They do not seek to imitate form, but to create form, not to imitate life, but to find an equivalent for life. Criticism of the show was again heated, fueled by more bafflement, and it became clear that a more substantial manifesto for post-impressionism was needed. Chatto and Windus asked Fry to write a book on the movement. He was too busy and suggested Clive Bell instead. Art, 1914, read and edited in manuscript and proof forms by his wife, became his most well-known book. The one quality common to all visual art, he asserts in its opening pages, was significant form, that is, how lines and colours combined in a particular way, certain forms and relations of forms stir our aesthetic emotions. The book advocated a total separation between art and life, something that Fry, especially later on, was never completely certain about. One of the most quoted passages from Art is that to appreciate a work of art, we need to bring with us nothing from life, no knowledge of its ideas and affairs, no familiarity with its emotions. In 1913, certainly, Vanessa Bell shared this view. I often look at a picture, for instance, I did the Picasso trees by the side of a lake, without seeing in the least what the things are. She wrote to her brother-in-law, Leonard Woolf. I got quite a strong emotion from the forms and colours, but it wasn't changed when weeks afterwards it was pointed out to me by chance that the blue was a lake. This happens as often as not. The picture does convey the idea of form, but not the idea of form associated with anything in life, but simply form separated from life. She ends by thanking her stars she needn't really bother about this very confusing subject. According to Clive Bell, biography and history have no relevance to the artwork. They are completely redundant. To appreciate a man's art, I need know nothing whatever about the artist. I can say whether this picture is better than that without the help of history. It's an opinion that artists express time and time again. Whoever wishes to devote himself to painting should begin by cutting out his tongue, said Matisse. Louise Bourgeois believed that to be an artist, you need to exist in a world of silence. Lucian Freud remarked that any words that came out of his mouth concerning his work would be as relevant to it as the grunt a tennis player makes when he hits a ball. An artist's reticence can be a defence mechanism. If we know their intention, then we know where they have failed. But Bell and her circle seem to regard surrounding an artwork with silence as a gift to the viewer, allowing them to respond to it in the purest and most personal way. It is, above all, an indication of the authority of the image over the world. In the catalogue for a solo show of her sister's work in 1930, Virginia Woolf wrote, "One defies a novelist to keep his life through 27 columns of fiction safe from our scrutiny." But Mrs. Bell says nothing. Mrs. Bell is as silent as the grave. Her pictures do not betray her. Their reticence is inviolable. That is why they intrigue and draw us on. That is why, if it be true that they yield their full meaning only to those who can tunnel their way behind the canvas into masses and passages and relations and values of which we know nothing, if it be true that she is a painter's painter, still her pictures claim us and make us stop. They give us an emotion. They offer a puzzle. Studland Beach is not a conscious attempt, then, to express a particular memory or feeling about a person or a place. Unlike the oil on board sketch that it is based on, which was made in hot pursuit of a sight that would soon disappear, there is no attempt to describe the scene as it was, full of action and air and life. Instead, it is a tentative step towards the new kind of art that is just beginning to emerge in the early years of this decade, where what matters most is colour, shape and line. The people and the place in the picture do not represent anything. They are devices, not symbols. Her focus is on the way each shape and colour and curve relates to each other, and how they hang, as if poised on a set of scales, together. The colours have been altered to make each other sing, the figures simplified into silhouettes to give the composition strength, the lines exaggerated to pull the eye in a particular path across the painting, a chain of lookers leading from us to the figures on the left, to the figures on the right, and then to the sea. Everything in it is a significant form. Nothing is superfluous to the design. It is her attempt to distill an experience of sitting on the beach, looking out to sea, down to its visual essentials. All you need to know about the painting is there in front of you, she might say, if she was standing at your side. Don't you think about who I am, or who they are, or what I'm trying to do? What do you feel? Not long ago, I returned to the Tate Britain to find that Vanessa Bell's Stutland Beach had been replaced by her abstract painting, circa 1914. Consisting solely of blocks of flat colour, all narrative had been vanquished from the canvas. It is the idea of significant form taken to its limit, and was one of the first fully abstract paintings ever to be made in Europe. The work is amazingly prescient, but somehow the image does not stick in my mind as Stutland Beach does. To write this, I have to find an image online to remember that is composed of pink, blue, teal, orange, and red oblongs floating against a chrome-yellow background. It is not a surprise to read in the accompanying text that it was part of a private experiment that went no further after the war. When Quentin Bell asked his mother why she had given up on abstraction, she replied, "Having done it, there seemed nothing else to do." I wonder, as Vanessa Bell strived to portray the emotional elements inherent in natural form, as Fry believed artists should, could Stutland Beach have tapped into something more fundamental? Long before it became the colour of distance, blue was used to symbolise a mother in mourning. The sea in her painting is close to the blue made from lapis lazuli, found in the frescoes of Giotto and Piero della Francesa, when the precious pigment was reserved for the Virgin Mary's robe. The Bells and Roger Fry admired these early Italian painters almost above all others. If Vanessa knew these images by heart, these illusions would have been intuitive. In the soft peak shape made by the bathing tent, you can see an echo of the curtains parted by angels above the pregnant Mary in Piero della Francesa's Madonna del Parto, and also the parted cloak in his Madonna della Misericordia. That might explain why her bathing tent looks so different to the hard-roofed huts seen in the background of the Stutland snapshots. The connection of the sea with motherhood goes deeper still. In psychoanalysis, the sea is connected with origins, beginnings, and birth. Freud used the phrase oceanic feeling to describe the sensation of being at one with the world, or the perception of something without limits. The feeling, he believed, was the survival of the sense of union between the breastfeeding mother and child before the child is aware that other people exist. In Jungian analysis, the sea can be a symbol of the mother, one of the archetypes that express the collective unconsciousness. While Clive Bell's theory of significant form has no time for psychology or symbolism, it does rely heavily on the idea of the universal. It believes that something visual can give rise to an emotion felt by everyone, regardless of time or place. That painting was a quest, as Wolfe writes Into the Lighthouse, to get hold of that very jar on the nerves, the thing itself before it has been made anything. Rebecca Solnit expresses a similar idea in A Field Guide to Getting Lost. A memory written down ceases to be its true shadowy self. It loses that mobile unreliability of the life, risking its beauty. There is a fragility and a mystery to memory that evades language. Wolfe knew this. She often expressed her envy of artists not having to mediate through impure words. When she eventually came to write an elegy to her parents, to the lighthouse, she chose a painter to be the central character. She told Roger Fry that if she had dedicated the book to anyone, it would have been him, saying, "You have, I think, kept me on the right path, so far as writing goes, more than anyone." Set in a house by the sea, To the Lighthouse draws extensively on childhood memories of summers spent in Cornwall, so much so that the flora and fauna she describes are entirely unsuited to the Hebridean location of the novel. Vanessa was deeply moved when she read it, praising her sister for summoning, through the figure of Mrs. Ramsay, a portrait of mother which is more like her to me than anything I could ever have conceived possible. And she teases her about her own similarity to the painter in the book, asking, "By the way, surely Lily Briscoe must have been rather a good painter, before her time perhaps, but with great gifts, really?" The book is structured around the Ramsay children's desire to sail to the lighthouse, a wish that stretches across many years. In the final part, they return with Lily Briscoe to the house on Skye, where they had all stayed years before. Mrs. Ramsay has since died, we are informed in parentheses,
As the Ramses finally set sail for the lighthouse, Lily pitches her easel on the edge of the lawn and begins to paint a view she had struggled with during her previous visit. Lily stepped back to get her canvas, so, into perspective. It was an odd road to be walking, this of painting. Out and out one went, further and further, until at last one seemed to be on a narrow plank, perfectly alone, over the sea. And as she dipped into the blue paint, she dipped too into the past there. As she works, the Ramses close in on the lighthouse. Memories of Mrs. Ramsay surface in Lily's mind, cresting to a wave of grief that recedes only as her painting moves towards its resolution. She saw it clear for a second. She drew a line there, in the centre. It was done. It was finished. Yes, she thought, laying down her brush in extreme fatigue. I have had my vision. And with that final sentence, Wolfe lays down her pen, leaving us alone with hers.
It is tempting to see Vanessa Bell in Lily Briscoe and Stutland Beach as Lily's grief-grained painting in To the Lighthouse. As we have seen, though, that would go against the flow of ideas swirling around Vanessa while she conceived the painting, and it would also be too straightforward. The introduction of my copy of To the Lighthouse quotes a sharp warning from Wolfe not to try and decipher imagery so simply. I meant nothing by the lighthouse, she wrote to Roger Fry, knowing that he was continually confronted with similar misunderstandings about painting. One has to have a central line down the middle of the book to hold the design together. I saw that all sorts of feelings would accrue to this, but I refused to think them out, and trust that people would make it the deposit for their own emotions, which they have done, one thinking it means one thing, another another. Just as Vanessa rejected symbolism in painting, Virginia insisted that the central motif in her work should not be interpreted any one way. The lighthouse did not represent anything. It was a device, not a symbol. Wolfe, like many people since, never assumed the uncompromising position Clive Bell took on the separation between aesthetics and experience. How could she, when she believed that the present, when backed by the past, is a thousand times deeper than the present when it presses so close that you can feel nothing else? Her oblique, shimmering way of writing reflected her fascination with the slippery behaviour of time. She loved that her sister's art was a puzzle. She understood perception to be a paradox, and one that did not, and should not, need to be resolved. The lighthouse, James Ramsay notices when he eventually reaches it, was a stark column striped with black and white, and not the silvery, misty-looking tower with a yellow eye, seen so longingly from the house. But instead of giving one image authority over the other, Wolfe has him think, so that was the lighthouse, was it? No, the other was also the lighthouse, for nothing was simply one thing. Stutland Beach offers a glimpse into Vanessa's world, not Lily Briscoe's, not her sister's. It is her vision of the beach that we can see when we look at the painting today, her family, her impressions, her memories. But nothing is simply one thing. It is also the other world she had been building for herself since childhood, a realm of her own making composed of brushstrokes and oil paints. As she transposed her recollections of Stutland onto canvas, she was striving to communicate the pure form of what she had seen in her language of shapes, colours, line and shade. She was seeking to create a new reality on the canvas, in Fry's words, to find an equivalent for life, not just an imitation of life. But both intermingle in the image she made, for it was through the process of painting and through art itself that she found a way to live.